Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Swinging a line drive, base hit into left field. Kinsius around third. He's coming home. Throw way off line. He scores standing up. Two-run single for Victor, and the Tigers take a 2-1 lead in the third. Swinging a drive to center field. Collins on the run. Dies, but it's by him all the way to the deepest part of the ballpark. He better hurry. Rounding second, heading to third is Betts. He's being waved and then held at third base. Two-out triple for Mookie Betts, and the Red Sox have tied it at 3 in the 8. Miguel hits a fly ball deep to right center field. Way back in right center, and gone, a home run! Looked like it hit the top of the fence and carried into the bullpen. Miguel Cabrera with his 21st, and the Tigers take a 4-3 lead in the ninth. Swinging a fly ball, right field, fairly deep. Avila's going back, he's got it in range, he makes the catch, and the Tigers sweep the Red Sox here in Boston.
Fantastic, boys.
I thought coming out of the shoot, he really had good stuff. I think he was a little excited to pitch against Strasburg. Combination of falling behind, we didn't complete the double play, led to like 37, 36 pitches for an inning. And fortunately, I mean, he gave up two, no more, in Strasburg. He's really good. You know, you hear me talk about our guys a lot of times. Weapons, he has a lot of weapons to, you know, he can throw the ball by you. Fastball, both sides of the plate, he cuts it. Slider, he's got everything.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Once again, great montage, a little baseball style there for you from Mr. Jim Cushlin. Well done, sir. Appreciate that. We're going to start with the Major League Baseball as we get closer and closer. Boy, doesn't it seem like it's dragging? It's really weird.
That's why they call this the dog days, Bob.
No. I mean, not the season. Until the deadline.
Oh, yeah.
You know what
okay,
I mean?
All right, I see where you're going.
That's,
yeah, it is, isn't it?
That's really dragging. It's really weird. You know, it's like, I don't know why, but oftentimes, in many years, it's like, bang, the trade deadline's here and what moves are made. And we've been counting them down now seemingly for 2 weeks. And maybe it's just because this year, unlike some other years, you know, there's a whole lot of speculation as to what the two teams that we spend the most time talking about here on the ticket, you know, are going to do. Are the Tigers going to stand pat? Are they going to sell? Are they going to buy? Are the Indians, who are first place and have been for quite some time now in the division, going to sell? Or not sell, excuse me. Are they going to buy and be willing? And if they buy, are they going to buy big and be willing to part with major prospects in order to, you know, find that bullpen arm or to find that outfield bat that they really believe they need to win this division and clinch it? So it's really, maybe that's why it seems like we're just, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop, as it were, for somebody to say this is what we're doing. But, heck, it's only Thursday, and the deadline isn't until Monday. So it just seems like we've been counting it down for so many days. The fact that, no moves have been made yet, really. I mean, the Aroldis Chapman move has been made by the Cubs and the Yankees, of course. But since no moves are being made by these AL Central teams, this is like tick, tick, tick.
Yeah, the only thing
talk,
we could, yeah, no kidding.
Tick.
And the only thing we could do is try to have fun with some of the rumors that get floated around out there this time of year. I'm not sure how much you buy into it. One, for example, that I'm scratching my head on because I've been under the impression, based on what Al Avila said.
Splinters in your finger yet?
Huh?
Do you get any splinters in your finger yet?
I might. I may very well throw because of this. Who knows? But, you know, think about, for example, what Al Avila had basically said over the weekend. We're probably going to stand pat. We're viewing our getting our guys back, all that stuff. And I hear rumors today that they're trying to get into the Jonathan Lucroy sweepstakes, which is a place the Indians have been rumored for, at least from a national perspective, for a while now. I'm still not sure that they're going to do that. They've tried to deflect that, have the Indians, but that's just one example
well,
right there.
You know, I read about that yesterday, late yesterday, after we got off the air, you know, last night sometime. And the kind of the feeling, at least among a lot of the Cleveland sports writers, is that this is they don't really need Jonathan Lucroy. They're not terribly interested in Jonathan Lucroy, but they're trying to catch the Indians. And that means if you want him, we want him first, just to keep him away from you. And not only to keep him away from you so that you don't get better, obviously, but if we can't keep him away from you, if we offer some, you know, some deal to the Brewers, then maybe it drives the price up for you to get him, so it hurts you in the long run. And that's just kind of been the, you know, some of the scuttlebutt going around over the course of the last couple of days. I don't know what's going to happen, but I do know that the Tigers are not standing pat quite as simply as Al Avila says. Al Avila said, we're just going to stand pat. We're going to do what we do, and we'll get J.D. Martinez back, and that'll be like an acquisition. We'll get Zimmerman back. We'll get Norris back. We'll get everybody back. It'll be like trading acquisitions anyway. But I don't believe that. I think a lot of that is just a snow job, you know, or smoke screen, whatever you want to call it, in order to kind of keep everybody off of their trail and off, you know, not, you know, figuring out what they're going to do. Making teams like the Indians a little more nervous and maybe a little bit more willing to part with more than they want to add whatever they have to do to hold off the Tigers and win this division.
Yeah, and that does seem like at times what's going on. That very well could be the case in this, because you look at the Tigers' catching situation. You brought in veteran Jared Solomachia to be the backup. He's a free agent at the end of the year. He's one of the names I keep throwing out there as why the Tigers wouldn't necessarily sell, because
right.
Who are they going to sell? That's one of the very few that are veteran free agents after this season. The other one's Mike Avilas. And then on the flip side, Lucroy is a guy who is signed pretty decently friendly from a team perspective through next year. So you get, it's not just a rental. It wouldn't be just a rental for a couple months. But then again, I thought this was a team that was trying to give the full-time duties going forward to James McCann. You know, that's why Alex Avila is off, injured, by the way, in Chicago right now. And Salty's brought in as veteran. They wanted to go with the young guy, which would be counterproductive to bring in a guy like Lucroy, even if it's more, again, than just a rental for this year. But then again, I'm going to go ahead and, because I've been on the assumption, Bob, that the Tigers would more or less stand pat based on what Al Avila said over the weekend. But if you're the same organization here on July 28th, it's Thursday, deadline is 4 p.m. on Monday, you're 4.5
back
suddenly.
Your deficit's only 4.5
right,
now, right?
Which is as close as it's been for anybody in the Central behind these Indians in a month and a half.
And by the way, while the Tigers have closed that gap, winning 3 in a row, sweeping the Red Sox, obviously, while the Indians lose 4 out of 5.
Right.
While that happens, you notice that the Royals haven't made up any ground at all. The Royals have lost 7 of their last 10. They're 8.5 back. They're a half game behind the White Sox, and the White Sox are pretty much done.
Yeah, and the White Sox are basically those two are basically 500 teams now. And for the first time all season, you know, all four had been really bunched up together until the Indians went on their winning streak at the end of June.
Yeah.
Now there's a separation between Cleveland, Detroit, and the next two. And Minnesota's, of course, been out of it since day one because they're just horrid this year. And you know, this goes back to what we said and have been speculating and saying, that the Tigers are probably the Indians' biggest competition down the stretch here in this division because of the issues with the other teams, and that puts teams like Kansas City in a bind. You know, do they sell some of these guys? I read yesterday, I forget through which entity it was, I apologize, but it was pointing out all those young guys who you've seen in the World Series last year, Hosmer, Moustakas, Dyson, Davis. I mean, there's at least 3 or 4 others that I'm forgetting are all free agents after next year. What do you start doing? Do you start selling them this year and next year so you don't lose them all to free agency? And then I read Chicago, who just acquired him, 2 months ago, are maybe offering James Shields out there, too. So there's now suddenly a separation in this American League Central between Cleveland, Detroit, and the rest.
Yeah, there really is. I think they've risen to the top. And, you know, I'm not terribly surprised by that, with the exception of the Royals part. You know, you and I and I think everybody we talk to.
Injuries and bad starting rotation. That'll make you a 500 team just like
that. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. But, you know, we slept on them the last couple of years. Then they rise up, go to 2 straight World Series, win the World Series last year. And I thought they would be bigger factors here. But, you know, we talked about the Indians at the start of the season, back before April 1. We talked about how the Indians have the best starting rotation in baseball or in the American League, potentially. the best starting rotation in the American League, and the Tigers have probably the best lineup 1 through 9, certainly in the American League Central, and that those two teams could very well be battling it out for the division championship. Once the Indians opened up that 6.5-7-game lead, though, I really felt like it was going to stand up, and it was going to stay that way for a while. But they hit the skids a little bit. You know, they ran into some hot teams, particularly three losses in a row in Baltimore. Then maybe the best pitcher in the National League, not named Clayton Kershaw, with Kershaw out, Steven Strasburg yesterday. And suddenly, you know, the Tigers get hot at the right time as the Indians get cool, and it's a 4.5-game thing. So there's an interesting article over at ESPN.com by Katie Strang, asking about the Tigers. A year after Detroit's deadline fire sale, Tigers feel ready to make a run. And it talks about Dave Dombrowski, who did not believe last year that Detroit was a playoff team, so he made the decision to sell. Of course, we remember David Price. And in my heart, Dombrowski, now of course president of baseball ops for the Red Sox, he said, in my heart, we weren't good enough to win at that time. And I ended up expressing that, and those were not the words, obviously, that Mike Yelich wanted to hear. And the decision was made, and here we go. Now he is gone. He is in Boston, and the Tigers are in a very different place right now. And this is I still don't think it's any better than one-third, one-third, one-third. I can't say 50-50. I don't think it's any better to say that it's one-third, one-third, one-third. It's, you know, there's probably about a 33% chance that they're going to sell, a 33% chance they're going to add, and a 33% chance that they're going to stand pat. Maybe if I had to adjust those at all, now that we're Thursday and it's the 28th and we're, you know, 3 days away, essentially, if we go Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the deadline being at 4 o'clock on Monday, so I guess we could say 4. But if I had to adjust that, maybe I adjust it down to, say, 20% selling assets, 40% adding big pieces, and 40% standing pat, if I had to adjust that. But I still don't think we're any closer to really understanding what it is they want to do. Do they believe that they are, within 4.5 games of the Indians, better than the Indians and built the way they are right now to defeat them and win this division and go into the playoffs and make noise? Or do they think that, you know, if it happens, great, but we're not going to be able to mess with anything. We're already thin as paper,
right,
in our farm system. We have very little to choose from already. We can't get rid of every little last piece we have to make this run that we think is going to be questionable at best as to whether or not we finish it.
Yeah, absolutely on that one. And that's part of the debate that Al Avila and the rest of the staff have to be having over these next couple of days. How for real do they think the 4.5 game deficit is? I mean, let's face it. The ground is being made up by the Tigers, mostly on the grounds of the Indians, as you just mentioned, having lost 4 of 5 right now. And that's going to determine what they want to do. There's a couple other teams who at least are publicly claiming they're in that same kind of boat. The Yankees. Yankees, for one, is a possibility that they've kind of said that they're going to let after Chapman, they're going to let these next couple days go. And if we feel it's going south, then we'll start trading your Beltrons and your Millers. But where the debate is, what overall strategy will the Tigers take? The Indians one, Bob, is one that I'm looking at, is which angle are they going to go in? I haven't heard as much, for example, in the wonderful fun rumor mill. That's, again, always fun and bordering on hilarious, depending on what you're reading this time of year. But I haven't heard as much because of that Yankee position on Miller the last couple days. What I am starting to hear is maybe a guy like Eduardo Nunez, who's having an all-star year with Minnesota, that they could put him at third, for example, not have to play Juan Uribe anymore. Mm-hmm. One of them is possibly, and this is ESPN's Jerry Kranzik with this one, saying, in addition to Lou Croy, the Indians are asking about reliever lefty Will Smith, because that's still essentially one of their
trying the same package for that deal. They're talking
right.
about getting them together.
Right, exactly, because, you know, whether you think of the catching spot or the outfield or whatever, the Indians will flat out tell you their number one priority right now is we need another reliever, preferably lefty, because they've only gotten 20-some innings out of all of their lefties all season long. You're going to need more than that come, you know, middle of October in a Game 3 of the ALCS. There's another one out there with the Rays, maybe looking at Steve Pierce. Here's another guy who could possibly play a corner outfield or third base if necessary. So for the Tigers, where it's what overall strategy it is. The Indians' question is, outside of hopefully a reliever, what position should they go? Should they look at this catching thing? Should they still try for another outfield back? Because we don't really know when Michael Brantley's going to be back. Should they look at somebody for third so they don't have to play Uribe and can permanently more or less put Jose Ramirez amongst the three remaining outfielders, Naquin, Davis, and Chisenhall? So that I'm very interested to see where that goes, because I still expect the Indians to at least attempt something more than just a reliever.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I think they kind of realized that they may have to. You know, I mean, again, if they were still sitting up there at 6.5 or 7, you know, closer to the – I mean, you don't want to go – here's a quote from Brad Ausmus. He said, you don't want to get caught up in day-to-day, but the more we win going into the deadline certainly doesn't hurt. You do get caught up going day-to-day. And if the day-to-day now had the Indians still up 6.5, 7, 7.5 or something like that, you know, they don't feel that urgency. But it's down to 4.5 now, and it might make them feel that urgency to look for more than, as you say, just one reliever or one particular spot. They're going to have to perhaps make, you know, multiple moves, two or three moves. You just don't, you know. The real key here and the real question for them, and this is life in a mid to small market franchise in America, and that is, do you give up so much of your future to run at a division title knowing that winning a flag is still a long shot, because the Rangers or the Red Sox or the Orioles, teams that you have struggled against a bit, are still waiting in the playoffs for you to try to get through them for the American League flag? And then if you do decide, I still think we can get past those teams if we make the right moves, we can still mortgage our future for it. Is it good enough just to get there, knowing that you may mortgage that future just to lose to the Cubs, for example, or the Giants or the Nationals in the World Series? The Indians are a good team. They have a really good pitching staff, but they are also a flawed team like most teams are. And when you are living in big city America, major market franchise America, perhaps you can afford to do that, take that risk and make that gamble, because you know you have an opportunity to buy your way back out of any mistakes that you make. You can buy prospects back in. You can make some moves and get back on the right track sooner rather than later. But when you're in middle to small market America, if you mortgage the top two or three of, or let's say two of your top four prospects, or three of your top six prospects, or something like that, to make multiple moves to get there, you better be saying, yeah, we're mortgaging the future, but this will make us the favorite to win the whole damn thing. And I don't know that they can say that. I don't know if they would believe that. And, you know, I don't know, even if they did think it or believe it, I don't know if they would, I don't know how realistic it really is.
Yeah, it's I'm not sure how realistic it would be either. Really want to think about it. And
I don't want to say that, because I don't want to be Debbie Downer. I really don't. But I mean, that, you know, it's weird, because they're geographically, the Indians and the Tigers obviously so close, and they're rivals for that reason. Division wise, they're obviously rivals for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very different. Detroit is bigger. Detroit has more money. I mean, talking about the city of Detroit, they've got bigger dollars coming in by way of media contracts. They have a bigger payroll, a much bigger payroll. They have a much more freewheeling billionaire owner who's willing to put that money out there and to make those gambles. And if they gamble and fail, again, they have at least expressed in, you know, recent years the willingness to buy their way back into where they need to be. And they can turn a rebuild from a, you know, 5 or 6 year proposition to a 2 year or a 1 year proposition. Whereas the Indians, if they lose their best prospects early, it's almost the better part of a decade to recover before you can really, really get back again. Because the way they have to deal with things in small market America, in Cleveland, Ohio, for example, you know, when Jason Kipnis's contract is up, chances are he's not going to be staying in Cleveland. They don't have the money to keep players like that. When Francisco Lindor's now he may get a nice, you know, club-friendly contract in the early going, but he's not going to be a guy. I mean, it's just like they talk about even in Washington. That's a big market, but, you know, Bryce Harper's probably going to be a Yankee in a year or 2 years or whatever it is he's got left on his deal. When you get these young studs, Carrasco and Kluber and Salazar and the arms that they've built, and the position players that we're talking about that have meant so much to their resurgence right now, they're not going to be here for a long time, which is why it's so crucial to keep the the farm system strong and you know, just stocked with stud prospects, because when these guys go, and they're going to go, it's just the way that it is, going all the way back to the 90s. You know, you couldn't keep Albert Bell here or there. You couldn't keep Manny Ramirez. You couldn't keep Jim Thome. You couldn't keep Robbie Alomar. You couldn't keep these star players around for the duration of a championship type of run. And that's going to be the case now. And the only way you stay relevant is to say, well, look who we've got to call up in a year. Look at the talent we've been able to assemble down there. If you
right.
get rid of it for one run that doesn't net you a title, it's just risky. It's risky business.
And the other aspect of along those lines, Bob, is it also means whether you're talking about deadline buying, deadline selling, or off season, you have to hit on your trades, whether you're bringing in a major league guy for some of your prospects, or on the flip side, if you're selling off one of your veterans, some of your prospects can, you know, actually hit. For example, it's been all these years since the infamous, for example, Cliff Lee deal, but the only one left on the roster, and at least it's a good one, is Carlos Carrasco. The rest are all gone. And that was, what, middle of 2009, so 7 years ago. You have to be able to hit on these moves, whether and specifically on the trade market, again, whether you're selling or buying, or it's during the off season.
Well, it's more the selling. It's more the selling.
Especially the selling, yes. Especially the selling. You have to make sure.
When you're buying, it's the other way around. The other team's got to hit on you, and they've got to take your best prospects and make them the right ones, because the chances are you're buying only a rental guy anyway.
And my example of buying in recent years would have been giving up Pomerantz and White for Ubaldo, who, quite frankly, let's face it, he had a really good one half of a season, did help lead to that single game playoff appearance.
No doubt. He was huge.
He was kind of bordering on awful the rest of his time. Flip side, Pomerantz looks like he's going to be having a decent career. He's now just been traded to Boston, as we know, to help out in their rotation. I haven't honestly heard of Alex White, though, in about a year, and I know he had some arm trouble, so that's kind of a wash. But if you're going to give up prospects, you got to make sure, even if it's just for half a season to get you in the playoffs like Ubaldo, that you sort of hit on it. You can't completely miss. And that's why in a market like the Indians are in, and what they play with relative to, say, the Tigers, or even more blatant examples, your Yankees, your Red Sox, your Dodger types, even the Cubs, they try to crybaby themselves that they're a small, they're not. The Cubs are a big market team. Never let them fool you on that. You have to be able to hit, I think, more importantly on trades than on the free agent market, because that's really where you're going to change out a lot of things.
I agree. The biggest thing is not being taken advantage of when you become a seller. You know, not giving up too much to get the piece that you needed to get you over the top. By the way, you mentioned Alex White. He's out of baseball. He's done.
I knew he had arm problems the last year and a half. I didn't know if he was still with somebody's organization
He also had legal problems, too. He had some DUI or drug bust or something like that.
Oh, I didn't even catch that one.
Yeah, that was not long after he left Cleveland, actually. It was around, like, I don't know, 2012 or something like that. But he's out of baseball. He went to the Rockies, as we know. That's where the trade was.
Right.
Then he went to Houston, and I think
that's where I last remember seeing him amongst Houston's organization.
They released him, and then I think there was another. Somebody else had him for a cup of coffee, and then he was done.
I think it was Oakland or somebody like that.
So last year was his last year. He's out of the game. So
and that's the thing right there, because if you recall back to deadline day 2011 when they picked up Ubaldo, at the time, Alex White and Drew Pomerantz were the Indians' stud prospects who were number one picks the last two and three drafts before. So, like, not that summer's draft, but the draft before in the one. So 2010 and 2009. White and Pomerantz were your first round draft picks.
Right.
Those were, in other words, those are some of your most highly rated prospects, and they had to give both of them up to get Ubaldo.
So that's the key, obviously. And, you know, we point out, you know, you mentioned the Cliff Lee deal. When they traded Cliff Lee, Cy Young Award winner, and you can even go back to the year before, the only team in history to trade Cy Young Award winners in back to back years, with CC Sabathia. Remember, the gem of the Sabathia trade was supposed to be Matt Laporta.
He was the
hitting machine. He was the AAA, considered widely, not just the best AAA hitter in the Brewers organization, but just period in the International League. He was just a stud in the making. And Michael Brantley was the throw-in. And fast forward, here we are. Matt LaPorta is out of baseball. Michael Brantley, although injured, is an all-star and a Silver Slugger winner. Next year, they said that Carrasco was the best of the closest to being ready players that they could get in the deal and still make the deal. It wasn't their first choice.
Right.
I remember this very directly. I can't remember who their first choice was anymore, but their shopping list at Philadelphia when they made that move included another pitcher that Philly wouldn't part with, and so they settled on Carrasco. Saying at the time, then two other guys, who was it? Lou Marcin, the catcher.
They had Lou Marcin, and Jason Donald, an infielder,
a veteran infielder.
And I believe Nick Hagedone, a lefty reliever who's been up and down the last couple of years, was
Hagedone came from Boston in the other deal with Victor, didn't he?
Oh, you know what? Yeah. I apologize. I am getting the two confused. You're right. He came
from
the Victor deal.
The other
deal,
guy you're thinking of, and this is the payoff here of all where I'm going with all of this. Carrasco was expected to be the closest to being major league ready.
Right.
Marcin and Donald were prospects.
Okay.
That's about it. But the gem of all of this was supposed to be an 18-year-old named Jason Knapp.
That's it. I knew there was another, like, young pitcher, and I got it confused. That's the one, yes.
And he was only, again, he was 18, but he was a fireballer. He was like, you know, upper 90s kind of heat.
Right.
And they, at the time, they said, and he had arm trouble at 18. But they said they did their homework and blah, 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 and we won't see a payoff on him for 3 or 4 years, but he's the real gem of that trade for Cliff Lee. And again, now here we are. Fast forward. Marcin and Donald are both gone, and in fact, I don't even know if they're in baseball anymore. Look how fast that can happen, by the way, now. All the guys we just mentioned that aren't in the game anymore. LaPorta, Alex White. If Lou Marcin is still in baseball, I'll be very surprised. But Carrasco ends up being a star caliber pitcher, a front of the rotation guy, which they didn't, you know, they thought he'd be good and could be major league ready, but not this good. Took a little longer than they thought, too.
I was ready to give up on him right before they did that switch a season and a half ago. Personally was ready to give up on him. I felt I had seen enough.
Oh, no, I didn't. I was very, very, very insistent upon this point. I always felt like they just needed to let him ride out his struggles and let him go. His arm was that electric. That's what I said. And that was including when he had a disastrous turn as a starter. Then they sent him back to the bullpen. In the bullpen, he was lights out. And it was evident he's got the goods here. And whether he stays as a back end, reliever, or they put him back in the rotation again, he's got the goods. They just have to help him with his confidence. And, you know, bang, here he is. He is a front end guy. You know, between him and Salazar and Kluber, I'm not going to say that any one of the three are better than any of the other three, to be quite frank. Kluber is the Cy Young winner, but he's also been the least consistent maybe of the three. Salazar's having a career year this year, and Carrasco is doing more dominating. Now, he had to go on the DL, but he is dominating as he had for, you know, other spells leading up to this. So, anyway,
and don't forget Bauer. Francona and the staff did the same thing they did with Carrasco. Send him into the bullpen to start a season, and he's turning in a pretty fine season too.
And I think he'll get better and better and better. The problem with that one is I just feel like, you know, and we'll see where it goes. But we've talked about this many times. They started the season wrong with Bauer. You know, they wanted to get Cody Anderson into that rotation. But he did not pitch well all spring. Bauer pitched circles around Cody Anderson and Josh Tomlin. The fact that they were the three the four and the five starters instead of Bauer, to me, was wrong. It did Bauer wrong, and Bauer deserved to be in there from the get-go. And no disrespect to Tomlin, who's obviously having a very good season and doing exactly what's expected of him. Cody Anderson has been a disaster. He is a human yo-yo. He has just gone up to Cleveland, down to Columbus, up to Cleveland, down to Columbus.
By the way, I've wondered about him. You know,
he's walking the dog. I mean, seriously, just back and forth and back and forth.
And when it comes to Cody Anderson, Bob, I've been wondering this because, you know, sometimes they always try to say, even in recent years, oh, well, we don't have quote unquote tape on the guy, which is, of course, silly because they have enough scouts and all sorts of other things that they do somewhere. But remember, he came up last year having basically skipped over AAA, come more or less straight from AA, and major league hitters hadn't seen him. Well, they got plenty of him last year that quote unquote tape was on him, and maybe they just adjusted.
I've been wondering about
about Anderson all season because it's been night and day, and it doesn't seem to be an injury thing.
Well, back to the original point, and we ended up getting into a lot of different tangents there. Back to the original point about Knapp. He was supposed to be the gem of that group of guys that came in for Cliff Lee, ended up having more arm troubles and is out of baseball. So you look at guys that are supposed to be your studs that you trade for at the deadline. Knapp is out of baseball. Carrasco paid off. Laporta is out of baseball. Brantley paid off. Alex White, whom you traded, is out of baseball, but Pomerantz paid off for, you know, not the team necessarily the team you traded him to, but right now with the Red Sox, he is a very quality starter. So you really have to hit on those. And again, unless you're in a big market, if you're in a big market, you can miss on some of those and rebound faster than you can if you're in a small market. If you miss on the acquisitions that you're trying to get when you trade at the deadline, when you sell at the deadline, you're going to pay the price for years to come. If you miss in the other direction, in that you give up the wrong prospects who turn out to be stars for your short-term rental, you again are going to pay the price for years to come. And that's why it's so very, very delicate right now with 4 days to go, and we'll call it four, counting tomorrow and the weekend and half of the day on Monday when the deadline comes at 4 o'clock. So it's a very, very delicate situation. All right, really good conversation. We want you to be a part of it, by the way. If you're a Tigers fan or if you're an Indians fan, should your team buy or sell or stand pat? And I think with the Indians, it's clear they're going to buy, but how much are you willing to give up with and how much are you really looking for to gain? If you're the Tigers, if you're a Tigers fan, you probably got – it's a lot harder. It's a lot harder to decide because, you know, the list of prospects, which we've covered pretty in-depth, that they have to purchase with is not a very lengthy list. It's not a very deep list. If they're going to find a way to buy, they're going to find a tough road, I think is what it is. So we'll talk about that. Also, by the way, we had a conversation a week ago about changing the game of baseball, particularly with the speed of the game. And Rob Manfred, the Major League Baseball commissioner, was talking in an interview about some of the things that they've considered, and that means speeding up the game when it comes to relief pitchers. And there were a lot of different ideas that were kind of bandied about on our program and other programs as well. Well, Rob Manfred has broached the subject yet again. He was at Marlins Park, where they invited him to help unveil the logo for the 2017 All-Star Game that's going to be played there next July 11th in the Marlins' 25th season. They get the All-Star Game. So in kind of a wide-ranging interview, Rob Manfred talked again about speeding up the game of baseball, and he talked again about doing something differently with relief pitchers. What did he say? I will tell you, and then we'll get your reaction to that as we continue. Coming up by the way, I forgot, it's 3:38. We also are going to talk a little Big Ten football. We had the Mac Media Day program with Mark Beyer today, taking a look at the Rockets and the Falcons and the rest of the Mac. So we do have, of course, Big Ten football to get to as well. We talked with Paul Keels yesterday about the Buckeyes. We do want to talk to Rachel Lindsay of The Blade coming up in a bit about the Wolverines. So we have that on the table as well as Rob Manfred's comments on pitching and picking up the pace of the game. So we still have a lot of that to come. We want you to be a part of it, too. Get on board at 866-240-1065 on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
I was really pleased with our team, the way they went through spring practice. Thought it was extremely productive. Competition was very high for spots. You know, our goal right now as we finish up the summer is healthiest, most in shape, prepared team for August 8th, and then we'll take our shot from there.
Let's go blue, yeah, the home team. This the big house, Michigan Wolverines. If it ain't real, it ain't right. If you can't take a hit, take a hike. The legendary Big Ten champ said right. Motion Beckler motivated the might. Force so strong, it's on Saturday nights. Howard, Woodson, Brady took it to heights. Let's ball, hail to the victors, that's above all. I got one question, tell them all ball.
I got to tell you, Rachel Lindsay joining us now, who covers the University of Michigan Wolverines for the Toledo Blade. Rachel, first, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
I am outstanding.
Great.
I got a question for you.
Yes?
Actually, Coach Harbaugh does. Who's got it better than the Wolverines heading into the 2016 Big Ten season, Rachel Lindsay? Anybody?
Well, expectations are very high for the Michigan football program, but I'm sure if you ask there, their rivals in Columbus, they might have an answer for that. I believe there was a video that had gone out within the last week as a response to the new Michigan Hype video starring Jim Harbaugh. So
That's the one I was just playing. Were you not able to hear that?
I could barely hear the response to the Hype video.
Oh, yeah.
I heard the Buckeye one, and I just said, well, you know, this just got really interesting with this. But, yeah, it's fun. It was fun thing to do. It, you know, got a lot of the fan base amped up. And camp opens a week from Monday in Ann Arbor. So
I was hoping, Rachel, as I played that, you were able to hear it because I was
playing. I could hear it. Oh, here we go again. But you know, with the Big Ten media days earlier this week in Chicago, there's definitely a mindset among this Michigan football. There's a lot of enthusiasm, one of Jim Harbaugh's favorite words. You know, there are very high expectations as well. And of course, Jim acknowledged earlier, there are critics, and he has some pretty blatant statements for the critics. You know, says, we have to keep our focus on us. So,
yeah, Harbaugh, you know, obviously is doing things pretty much unlike anybody has ever done them, taking his team down to Florida for one of their spring weeks, spring football weeks, and ticking off half of the SEC while doing that, having these satellite camps from one end of the country to the other, and going out there and establishing the Michigan brand in different places all over the country. Now this rap video, which I literally cannot picture any other major college coach today taking part in, let alone spearheading, and it looks like this was kind of his idea, not the rapper Bailey from the Bay Area that he did this with out in San Francisco. This was kind of Harbaugh's idea, and I think he's just putting himself out there in a way that no other coach ever has, and some people see it as a lot of enthusiasm. Others see it as brashness and cockiness that is absolutely unwarranted from a guy who hasn't won anything yet in college.
Come on, you couldn't see Nick Saban doing a rap video? No, I'm totally kidding.
I can't picture anybody doing
totally.
That.
Not Urban? No, not
Urban Meyer, not Nick Saban.
Not Jason Candle?
Not Jason Candle, no.
That would be fun, though. I've said this before, Jim's putting the program out there. You know, Jim Harbaugh wants the program to be what it was against, which he played for Bo Schembechler. We all know Michigan, for years and years and years, was among the titans of college football. You know, whenever I would think of college football, I would think of Michigan, Penn State, Notre Dame. You know, those are some of those, four teams that, that just would dominate. You know, they were synonymous with college football. We saw the program tumble a bit under Rich Rodriguez, Brady Hoke, during the Brady Brand era. And, Jim was brought in, to bring the program back to prominence. He's got a great amount of charisma. He cares so much about that program, so much about that team. He loves football, and he's very tunnel vision, which is a good thing if you want to be, if you want to have a successful program. So, and Jim's being very, very innovative with everything he has done to get to this point to prepare for this season.
Rachel, I'm going to jump in here because I'm having a hard time making out a lot of what you're saying. I think there's a cell phone issue. I'm going to ask Jim to put you off the air for a second and try to correct that and see if we can correct that. In the meantime, I'll listen to a little bit more of Bailey and Jim Harbaugh just breaking it all down for everybody. By the way, this video, it literally was about 50-50 when we asked that question when it first came out last week, and we posted it all over our social media pages, and we asked for a poll. Is it awesome, is it cheesy, or a little bit of both? It was literally 50-50 between awesome and cheesy. And most people, I think, voted actually a little bit of both. But I got to tell you, the more I listen to it, the more I watch it, the more I watch the intensity of Jim Harbaugh in it, the more I'm impressed by it for Michigan fans. They got to be really jacked up about that. Just the atmosphere he's created around Michigan football. Look, Michigan football was in the dumper for a long time, and I don't mean just performance-wise and record-wise. I mean specifically, it was just a negative experience for so many people. It was just something that, when you talked about Michigan football, you didn't talk about it with the same reverence and the same, excitement. It's Brady Hoke football, and it's, it was Rich Rodriguez football. It wasn't Michigan football. And this just brings back Michigan football in a way that, I think it really needed. And then the excitement level is there. We're trying to reestablish our better connection with Rachel Lindsay. Jim, let me know if we have that and when we have that. We're going to try it. All right. Now, Rachel, are you there again?
I hope this works.
Okay. Well, we're doing our best. It's just, I think it's this crappy cell phone quality.
Okay.
It's
something
we've got to deal with sometimes. We'll do our best, and if it doesn't work, we'll just have to cut it short.
Okay.
Let's get to the meat and potatoes of this whole thing. Who's going to play quarterback for the Wolverines?
Who's going to play quarterback for the Wolverines? Either John O'Korn or Wilton Spate. Those are going to be the two front runners. Earlier this week in Chicago, Jim said, right now, it's an open slate. It's an open competition, you know. John O'Korn has a better number. When his freshman year at Houston, he threw for more than 3,000 yards. And at one point, I guess appeared to be a Heisman candidate, but had his struggles in his second year and transferred out of Houston, took the red shirt year off, and, you know, is now back in contention. He served as scout team quarterback last year, emulating a lot of the guys at Michigan State. And, you know, he's among the top candidates. And, you know, of course, as Jim said in Chicago, it's a meritocracy. You know, whoever earns it will have earned it. You know, that's who's going to be the winner. But, yeah, it'll either going to be Wilton Spate or John O'Korn.
Yeah, I heard a little bit of what you said, Rachel, but not enough of it, I don't think, to continue the conversation.
Okay.
It's just not going to work through people's speakers because it's burning up too much. So we're going to try to maybe get you back on tomorrow, something from a better place or from a landline.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah.
All right, thanks, Rachel. I appreciate the effort. You got it.
I
do appreciate the effort. It's just a little bit tough to do. We'll have to get her on a landline because that cell phone connection is just bad radio, and I can't do bad radio. All right. So Michigan begins with big expectations is what Rachel Lindsay said at the beginning. And I agree with that. She said, however, their counterparts down in the Buckeye State, down Ohio State way, Columbus way, would have a little bit of a disagreement about whether or not they're the team to beat in the Big Ten. You don't have to go far to find that disagreement because Rachel's colleague at the Blade, David Briggs, has put it out there today very, very directly. Actually yesterday, but I'm reading it today. That UM might be the trendy pick, but the Big Ten East, and the Big Ten champion is going to be Ohio State. He said, make no mistake about it. While all of those things are going on at Michigan and all of the excitement about rap songs and satellite camps and everything else, the best team is still Ohio State. Six returning starters or not, they are still the best team. His vote in the AP Top 25, and this is where Briggs, again, Rachel Lindsay's colleague at the Blade, this is where Briggs is really, really, unique on this. His vote in the first AP Top 25 poll will begin Alabama, Clemson, Michigan. Michigan number three. Yet, the pick to win the Big Ten, Ohio State. And this is what Briggs is saying, and I want to quote a little bit of this because I want to hear from some Michigan fans and Ohio State fans about whether or not they agree. Fool me once for thinking, quoting Briggs now, fool me once for thinking the rivalry had returned 4 years ago. Shame on you, Brady Hoke. This is no sequel. Harbaugh has won big at every level from the FCS to the NFL, where a salary cap is designed to assure parity. The oligarchic world of big-time college football is just the opposite. In 4 years at Stanford, he built the Cardinal into a national contender with middle-of-the-pack recruiting classes, ranked an average of 37th nationally by Rivals.com. Imagine what he can do over time at Ann Arbor, where his outsized personality combined with a blue-blood platform will allow him to separate from all but a handful of rivals like never before. His 10-win debut season was a good sign for the future of Michigan football, but his momentum toward a consecutive top-five class is an even better sign. So it sounds like he's about to say, yeah, Michigan's the team to beat. Michigan has the high expectations, which is what Rachel wrote. However, you have the Buckeyes. A Buckeyes team with six returning starters can be gotten good very early. The most inexperienced team in the nation, more than half of their scholarship players have 4 years of eligibility remaining, is so young, its game should air on Nickelodeon, writes Briggs. But its talent is level with the best teams anywhere. Meyer will take his new starters over your old ones every day and twice on Sundays, which is where most of them end up playing. He also welcomes back the preseason Big Ten Offensive Player of the Year in JT Barrett, who knows something about leading a youthful team in an apparent reset year like 2014. If history is any indication, Ohio State will only gain momentum. The Wolverines' job will be to keep theirs going. Their biggest question mark is the schedule. Michigan follows the league's softest opening stretch with the toughest finale, playing three of its last five at Michigan State, Iowa, and Ohio State. They're 0-12 in true road games against ranked opponents since 2006. Win the game at the Horseshoe, and the team in scarlet is no longer green. I'm sorry, with the game at the Horseshoe, excuse me. And the team in scarlet is no longer green, obviously, at the end of the season. The pick will be Ohio State. Take that to the bank, says David Briggs. So there is really a lot of discussion and a lot of dispute as to whether or not the season opens in the Big Ten with Ohio State looking up at their former doormat, which would be Michigan for the last decade or so, or whether or not Michigan is just a little bit premature in predicting greatness in Jim Harbaugh's second year just because Urban Meyer's group is a little untested with only six returning starters. So that's going to be an awful lot of fun. Apologies again for not being able to bring more of Rachel on the air, but like I said, the conversation was not working out well from an audio quality standpoint. We'll try to get her back on maybe tomorrow or early next week as we get closer and closer to big-time college football. So really, a lot of good college football conversation today. The MAC show today with Mark Beyer, the MAC Media Day program, 2 hours of outstanding coverage of the University of Toledo, as well as Bowling Green and the rest of the MAC. And now we have a little bit of Big Ten discussion as well. So we'll pick that up when we get into hour number two as well. I have not forgotten about Rob Manfred, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, and his latest commentary on speeding the game up. He made these comments yesterday in Miami, unveiling the new logo for the 2017 All-Star Game, which will be played down there at Marlins Stadium. So we're going to get into his comments, and we have a whole lot more to talk about as well from the Olympic side. Not going to be talking about how much human poop is in the aquatics venues where the athletes are going to have to compete this time. We're going to talk about the problems with Team USA, the basketball team. What? What problems could there possibly be? Mike Krzyzewski will tell you coming up, or at least I'll tell you what he said coming up, and when we get into hour number two of the extravaganza. Coming up on 3:58 now, SportsCenter time on ESPN 106.5.
Swinging a line drive, base hit into left field. Kinsley is around third. He's coming home. Throw way offline. He scores standing up. Two-run single for Victor, and the Tigers take a 2-1 lead in the third. Swinging a drive to center field. Collins on the run. Dies, but it's by him all the way to the deepest part of the ballpark. He better hurry. Rounding second, heading to third is Betts. He's being waved and then held at third base. Two-out triple for Mookie Betts in the Red Sox. Have tied it at 3 in the 8. Miguel hits a fly ball deep to right center field. Way back in right center and gone, a home run. Looked like it hit the top of the fence and carried into the bullpen. Miguel Cabrera with his 21st, and the Tigers take a 4-3 lead in the ninth. Swinging a fly ball right field, fairly deep. Avila's going back. He's got it in range. He makes the catch, and the Tigers sweep the Red Sox here in Boston.
Fantastic, boys.
I thought coming out of the chute, he really had good stuff. I think he was a little excited to pitch against Strasburg. Combination of falling behind, we didn't complete the double play, led to like 37, 36 pitches for an inning. And fortunately, I mean, he gave up two, no more, in Strasburg. He's really good. You know, hear me talk about our guys a lot of times. Weapons, he has a lot of weapons to, you know, he can throw the ball by you. Fastball both sides of the plate, he cuts it. Slider, he's got everything.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed it is. The Extravaganza Hour number 2 is underway now at 11 minutes past the hour of 4. We got you until 5 o'clock drive time coming your way once again with Jim Kushlin in for Mike Miller. Mike Miller gets more. It must be in the name Mike. Guys named Mike get more vacation, honestly, than the rest of us all put together. You realize that, don't you?
Seems that way.
Yeah, because, you know, Golic was out again today. Mike, the Mike and Mike show that really is features Mike and somebody else not named Mike.
I swear it'll eventually be Mike and Mike again.
It's never Mike and Mike. Mike and Mike is Mike and some other dude, or it's some other dude and Mike. Because if Greenberg is out, it's some other dude and Mike. And if Golic is out, it's Mike and some other dude. But very, very rarely is it ever Mike and Mike, which is just a bizarre thing. They get more vacay, honestly. I got to change my name. You know what? I probably could get away with it. I actually could, because that used to be my name. when I was, never mind, personal story, doesn't matter. All right, so we begin hour number two. Want to get right back into some baseball conversation after we took that little detour to college football with Rachel Lindsay and then quoting from her colleague, David Briggs. Do you agree with him, by the way, Kush, before we go back into Rob Manfred, the Major League Baseball commissioner? Briggs said that Michigan is going to be the higher-ranked team at the start, but that the Big Ten champion is going to be Ohio State.
I could see that, and he kind of laid it out because, you know, a lot of national people, because remember, we have to look, especially in this case, it's looking through it from that national prism. They're going to see that, oh, Ohio State has only, you know, six returning starters. It was one of the themes. Urban Meyer mentioned it at the Big Ten Media Day the other day. It's like, look, we got, you know, a lot of guys to replace. But I can understand where he's coming from because, as we know, Michigan v. Ohio State is always at the end of the season, and all these new guys, I would hope, if from the perspective of the Buckeyes, are a more cohesive machine by then, that they wouldn't be in early September. So, yeah, I could see a national ranking, for example, that has Michigan a little higher than Ohio State in early September. That might be flipped around come end of November.
And they
I
get a couple
that.
Of home games early on, too. You know, against Bowling Green and who's week number two? We were talking to Paul Keels about this yesterday with Ohio State. But they get a couple of games that you hope they can kind of get their feet wet. The young guys who have not been starters before, which, of course, is 16 of them, offensively and defensively anyway, 16 of them, they're going to get their feet wet. So you hope they get their feet wet and get comfortable.
It's
and get,
BG, Tulsa, and then on the road to Oklahoma in the third game. Then they have a bye week.
And that's the kind of thing you worry about. It's not necessarily about are they more cohesive unit, as you described, by the time they get to Michigan, to play against Michigan at the end of the year. It's do they lose one early or earlier before these guys become cohesive and comfortable in the lineup. And then, you know, it costs them overall in the standings and the opportunity.
Run. And if that game happens, it would be Oklahoma. Because, look, even though we're here in MAC territory and whether it's Saturday games. And by the way, for those who are curious, yes, I intend to do that again. Saturday BG games will be on Talk Radio 1470. But all those weekday MACtion games in November we'll have here on the ticket. Because what the heck else am I running on the ESPN on a Tuesday night, November? But you get Bowling Green. That'll be sort of tough. Because they're a decent team. Bowling Green's way better than Tulsa. Tulsa shouldn't be that difficult at all. But it's that Oklahoma game. If they're not a cohesive unit by then,
for Oklahoma with those first
It could turn into the road version of what happened 2 years ago when Virginia Tech beat Ohio State. If they're not fully with it yet. But I expect that they would become at Maryland, at Michigan State, and Michigan. That's your last three games in November.
And if it does become the road version of the Michigan or the Virginia Tech game, that's okay because they ended up winning the national championship that
year. Because even in this new playoff system, if you're going to lose, it still means lose early.
Exactly right. And speaking of the playoff system, by the way, I know we had that in the Sports Center updates.
Yes.
The college football semifinal games, they're tweaking the schedule a little bit.
Won't go into effect for this year because this year's already kind of set in stone.
Right. Well, for this year, it's going to be December 31st. The college football semifinals are going to be played in the Fiesta and the Peach Bowl, Saturday, December 31st. But for next year, on the 2017, it's going to be,
For the 2017 season.
For the 2017 season, yes, the games will be played Saturday, December 29th. In the Cotton and Orange Bowls, and then they will play the national championship game. Well, they don't have that. They just have the semifinals.
Right.
They just have the semis. So for the semis, that's how it will be. In 2018, it will be the Cotton and Orange Bowls. 2019, the Fiesta. The point being, it's not always going to be a New Year's Eve thing. They saw the ratings plummet last year, this past season, on New Year's Eve.
Right.
Maybe it was the matchups. Maybe it was the games. Maybe it was just that people are doing other things on New Year's Eve rather than wanting to stay home and watch college football.
Right.
Even though they are playoff games.
I still think it was mostly the latter. Look, on paper before you started it, that's how the bowl rotation worked, which meant some of them would be on New Year's Eve, and quite frankly, to a degree, you wouldn't have known how good or bad from a ratings perspective that would be until you actually did it. We now know the answer is if it's on New Year's Day, you're solid. If it's on New Year's Eve, no matter the matchups, you'll probably run into some problems and it won't work. So yeah, looking at the calendar for the December of 2017, that would be, Saturday the 30th for those two semis. You probably have a couple of minor bowls on New Year's Eve the 31st, and then the rest of them would be on January 1st, 2018. which happens to fall on a Monday for that particular calendar.
2020 as well, which would be a Friday. That's January 1st, 11 New Year's Day, and then 2023, the same thing. But they do still have the December 31st New Year's Eve game scheduled on some of them. Obviously, this year we pointed out, and then again in 2019, they're back on not 2019, 2021. It'll be a December 31st, 22. It's the same way. So they still have a few of those New Year's Eve things scheduled. But, Jim, we're out into, 7-8 years from now.
And I get, by the way, I'm looking at this 2021 December 31st falls on a Friday. That might be a little bit better. Maybe.
But here's my point, though. That's 5 years away.
Right.
We're getting out into 5, 6, 7 years away that we're starting to see these things. It may be an entirely new animal by then.
We might have our
I'm hopeful that by then we'll have an 8-team playoff. And now we've got to talk about quarterfinals before we talk about semifinals and championship games.
Well, yeah, and in such a situation, if and when, and I still, of course, always view it as more when than if, they expand it to 8, I still personally, and this may just be me, Bob, I hope what they do for that first round, those 4 quarterfinal games, because right now you have the championship games on that first Saturday, and then that very next day, that Sunday, usually in the NFL's pregame now, is when they're doing the quote-unquote selection show. Have those first round or quarterfinal, whatever round you want to call that, you got to have those the very next Saturday on a home road basis. Then you give the schools a couple weeks off for holiday and getting to the semis, which would still be on bowl locations. That's how I hope they do it. We'll see when it gets there, but that would be my way if
I was
in charge.
That's the only sensible way. Yeah. I completely concur. Everything that you just said. And they're going to deny and say, no way, it's never going to happen. But how many years in a row did they say for the last 10, 15, 20 years, but particularly when the BCS was kind of born, how long did they say, we are never going to have a playoff? Understand this. We don't do playoffs.
At least every year for the first 10.
Yeah. I mean, and they were just adamant about it. And they were, that the playoff devalues the regular season. And the only way what makes our sport the best is that every game is a playoff week. If you lose in September, it's just like losing in December. These are all playoff games. If we have playoffs, then the games in September don't matter. And that was their argument for so long. And yet here we are. Headed to year number 3 of a college football playoff. So while they say it's never going to be expand beyond 4, give them another 4 or 5 years and watch and see. Maybe it'll take longer. I don't know. But give them another 4 or 5 years and watch and see how quickly they go to 8.
I think another new X factor for the when, not if, is what happens with the Big 12's expansion. As we know from their media day a week and a half ago, they're going back out there to try to expand. And it'll probably take a year or two before they finalize all the T's and cross all the T's, dot all the I's and all that stuff before 2018, most likely, when they get a couple new teams. And to either go to 12 or 14, that new landscape might help in maybe pushing forward some kind of playoff where all 5 champs of the power conferences get slots, and then you'd have 3 open ones for Notre Dame and your second place SEC team or what have you.
Yeah, the Big 12 expansion is a tough thing. Do I have a problem with them expanding? No, I'm okay with that. But when I hear about the kind of schools that they're talking about adding, I got a big problem with.
Well, they got no choice. I mean, is somebody going to even leave the ACC to go to the Big 12? Doubtful. We know that's not going to happen for Big 10, SEC, or Pac-12. The Big 12 is in a bad spot because they can only go below at this point.
Yeah.
Unless they were to convince Notre Dame, and I think that's out of the cards.
No, that's not happening. That's not happening.
Right.
But, I mean, I'm just looking at schools that have no business being in a power conference like that, potentially being invited, whether it's like UCF was one of the schools mentioned, University of Central Florida. Why? How? In what way? They had one good year with Blake Bortles, and they won a bowl game, and suddenly, what, they're a power? They belong in a power conference?
FYI, they were 0-12, I believe, last year.
They were winless last year. Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. How does that help the prestige of your league?
That's why you got to pick correctly.
It's all about money.
Yep.
It's not about prestige. It's not about getting in a better opportunity to make the playoffs, although that is about money too. But it is. It's about the cash. It's a big cash grab. I understand they need to expand. I get it. And I understand there is a very, very small number of teams that are available or schools that are available unless you can pull them out of one conference and bring them over to yours. Personally, I would like to see that, by the way. you know, somebody in the ACC that would fit better in the Big 12 go there and then let, like, a UCF take that school's place in the ACC, which would just seem to be, geographically anyway, a better, you know, a better fit. They are literally on the Atlantic coast anyway at UCF.
Yep. And that's why I think, you know, especially let's view it through the prism of that last Big Ten expansion from a couple years ago, right, when they brought in Maryland and Rutgers.
Which I hated, too. That's another thing.
But,
I mean, because they don't belong. And then, you know, the Big Ten is Midwest football, with the exception of Penn State, which is Pennsylvania, still kind of, sort of, maybe, I guess, a little Midwest, but you understand the point.
Sure.
You know, Rutgers is New Jersey, and Maryland, they just don't belong, but go ahead.
And of course they don't. You know, about both programs so far, the only one contributing anything on the field or court is Maryland basketball, which you would have expected. We never make any mistake. Those moves were not about getting schools with big-time true programs. It was about getting markets.
Exactly.
By getting Maryland, you get Baltimore and Washington. By getting Rutgers, you get New York City. The Big 12 can't take that approach. They actually have to go to schools that have more of an actual history on the football field and the basketball court while you're at it. And that's why I would expect and hope they're talking teams like BYU or somebody like a Cincinnati, especially because West Virginia is still on that island relative to the rest of the Big 12. I hear some of the rumors are Houston as another possibility. Yeah, those are the schools
that
they have to be
better.
Going
that
after.
That one fits better, though.
Right, and that's why those are the schools that I've heard in the rumor mill since this got announced a week and a half. I'm thinking, yes, you go for those kind of schools. You don't go for the Central Florida types. You're not here for TV markets, Big 12. You're here for as good a program as you can get in terms of on-the-field performances. It's a different dynamic than what the Big Ten was looking to do a few years ago.
I mean, first of all, why did Texas A&M ever leave the Big 12 to go to the SEC? See, to me, Houston is a fit. It's a natural fit. If you get almost all of Texas there.
They were formerly in those conferences in the old Southwest days.
Yeah, I mean, Baylor is there. Texas is there. You know, Houston could be there if Texas A&M was still there. Oklahoma State. I mean, it really is. I guess that's part of the problem for me is the geographical hook. The geographical hook that used to be there, when you were part of the Pac-12, it's because you are on the Pacific Coast, hence the name Pac-12 Conference.
And that's still
Pac-10.
Mostly the case for everyone except Colorado and Utah.
Exactly. But Colorado should be in the Big 12,
like they used to be with Nebraska, and
Nebraska should be in the Big 12. You know, they're a Big Ten team. At least geographically, I'm okay with that. It's not too far from Iowa. You know, and so we're in the ballpark, at least for some of those. But you start taking New York City teams or New Jersey teams, coastal teams like Rutgers and sticking them in the Big Ten. Or if you take teams like UCF and sticking them in the Big 12, or you take teams that are centrally, you know, Southwestern centrally located, like Texas A&M, and sticking them in the SEC, it just doesn't make any sense. I'm a big fan of the geographical, you know, the Big East, back when there used to be a Big East, the ACC schools all along literally the Atlantic coast, the SEC literally in the southeastern part of the United States. I mean, they were named that way for a reason, the Mountain West. And, you know, the Big Ten didn't really have a geographical name. Everything else did, but we knew where they were. I guess that part of it is what... It's kind of like we wanted Michigan to get good again, to get the rivalry back with Ohio State to make the Big Ten strong. For me, it's about geographical rivalries. Where do they play the best football in America? Which conferences boast the best teams? And they're all from, this is where they draw most of their players from. Mm-hmm. This is where they're all located. The southeastern part of the country, the northeastern part of the country, the heartland of the country, the south, not South Central, what I'm trying to say, but, you know, the Southeastern, no, I mean, the where the Big 12 is, what do we call Texas and
Texas
Mexico
and the Plains,
and
if you will.
You know, the South Central part of the country is what I'm trying to say there. You don't want to say South Central. I think you're talking about L.A., gangland. And then Pacific Coast and Mountain West and all the rest. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was football, I think college football, when it was in its prime, before all of the super conferences started to do what they did, picking teams from different places to make more money, as you point out correctly, from those markets, even if they didn't really lend themselves to natural rivalries against their geographical opponents.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, again, I hope that some of the teams like your BYUs and Cincinnati and Houston, I hope that's the avenue they're going and not the Central Florida. I heard one rumor, for example, said they might look into Connecticut, which would just be dumb.
That's another disaster.
Exactly. That would be a disaster for both ends. Did you say
Memphis yet? Memphis
is another one that's up there that would be more of a geographical kind of fit and help
is okay,
as well.
Although Tennessee, you know, I would still rather see just – I know we can't just swap them out like they're trading cards, but
right.
But I would like to. I'll give you Texas A&M back to the Big 12 if you give me Memphis to slot into the SEC.
And a school to be named later. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like we're just trading cards, but ultimately that would be better.
Yeah.
Memphis would be better in the SEC again because you're talking about Florida schools, talking about Tennessee schools, Kentucky schools, including Louisville and Kentucky.
Sure.
And
remember, and for the Big 12, for example, just use Memphis as an example real quick. It's not necessarily about, we got to get that, you know, Memphis TV market. That'll be helpful because, remember, the Big 12 will also be due to Texas and other issues. And if you bring in a BYU, them too, they're the only one of the Power Five that doesn't now does not have their own network. The ACC's just got launched. So the other four do have their own quote-unquote network now. But it's less important than for getting the Memphis quote-unquote market into the Big 12. That it would be to, hey, that's a program football-wise that have been in the dumps. They're playing a little bit better the last couple years, and they have a basketball history. That's the kind of angle you have to go in, and the better it is geographically, then the more it would work out.
And then that would be a better geographical fit. You got to get to 14 teams. Also, just so you have a playoff game, a conference championship game, I should say, and a better chance of getting into the playoffs, which is, of course, the ultimate goal here. But, yeah, geographically, I would really like just to stop all of this moving Connecticut into the Big 12 or UCF or any of these others that just don't make any sense. BYU I would live with. You know, Houston, it would be perfect, and Memphis would be okay.
And don't forget another small reason why the Big 12 may be deciding to have announced this now and that they're going to begin the process for it is it's hard to imagine it happening, but I'm just going to throw out there one last time the simple math. There are 10 teams in the Big 12 right now, right? To get to 16 teams, that whole rumor we've been hearing for about 8 years now since that first round of realignment came with Nebraska coming to the Big Ten, we're at a point where ACC, SEC, Big Ten, Pac-12, the number of open spots in each conference is equal to 10. What do I mean by that? If you split up all the Big 12, all 10 of them, and put them in all four of the remaining conferences, then those other four would be at 16. So if the Big 12 keeps kind of, messing around, that possibility of just breaking the whole thing up and spreading amongst the other four would happen, and then you'd suddenly have your four super conferences of 16 that we've been hearing so much about since that first realignment of 8 years ago now.
I really think they
I don't think
do
it'll
it.
Happen, but no. It's mathematically possible.
Yeah, it's just there just aren't enough schools available. That's the problem, as you pointed out, for everybody to be the right size that they need to be. Okay. All right, listen, it's coming up on 4:30. I wanted to do baseball that segment, but once again, you know, tangentially speaking, we just roll. We started out talking about Michigan and Ohio State and conferences and realignments and so on and so forth, and there you go. What I want to do is when we come back, I do want to tell you about the Olympic story. Mike Krzyzewski is not really thrilled with his guys, and it has nothing to do with their results because they're just destroying teams in exhibition play, including two games in a row against China that they won by a combined, 90 or something stupid. But he's not happy. I'll tell you about that. And then want to talk a little bit more about baseball and possible changes that could be made to speed the game up. Commissioner Rob Manfred, again, addressing something that he talked about 2 weeks ago that had the entire sports world flapping its gums and saying, hey, what is going to happen here? Are they going to fundamentally change the way the game is played just to speed it up? Is that necessary? Well, that happened 2 weeks ago that he was talking about that, or a week and a half ago. He brought it up again last night. So we're going to talk about it coming up right here on ESPN 106.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
All right, it's 4:37, so we got about 23 minutes of outstanding awesomeness coming your way before 5 o'clock. Then Jim Cushlin will bring you more of the same with Drive Time in for Mike Miller. Again, Miller just taking advantage of his Mike vacation. Mikes get time off, man. I got to tell you, I don't know how they do it. must be written into their contracts. But Mike is going to be off again until what? Monday? He's back on Monday.
He is
right?
back in the big chair on Monday. So you're stuck with me on drive time for two more days, today and tomorrow.
You're going to probably feel, honestly, like you're on vacation just by having to do your regular job next week.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I mean, seriously, when you finally have to stop covering everybody's behinds as much as you've had to do.
Hey, happy to do it, though. You know, even the extra couple hours today, we were, I know I at least speak for me, so grateful to be able to bring all of you guys. Mark Beyer from Ford Field for Mac Media Day. By the way, for those who hadn't seen, I posted this on the Ticket's Facebook page. That entire two-hour Mac Media Day show is podcasted right now on the website. It doesn't have it. It didn't have its own separate tab, so forgive me, Bob, but I put it under the Extravaganza tab.
Are you kidding? Forgive me. I'm honored. That's awesome. Mark Beyer is awesome. Mark is a legend in Toledo sports, Toledo area sports, and fine, by all means, send him to my podcast page.
And he talked to everybody today, coaches, players, beat writers, the play-by-play guys, even spoke for a few minutes with the MAC commissioner and Mid-American Conference's head of officiating. So if you want it related to MAC, it's now on the podcast site.
Nobody truly is more dialed into MAC sports, honestly, than Mark Beyer. I mean, he just is. I mean, this is his thing. This is his wheelhouse. He was the voice of the Rockets for how long? You know, for so many years, 20 years, 25 years, whatever it was. And the fact that he is still covering the teams and covering the universities as well as he is just awesome. And he'll do the same thing, I'm sure, for basketball. And I can't wait until we have, you know, our first broadcast from UT as well, getting ready as we do each and every year. So we're looking forward to great, great coverage. It's great to have Mark on the team working for us. And, yeah, that was a great show that he did. You make sure that everybody knows where to find it on that podcast page. So just look under the Extravaganza. Okay, couple of things just to follow up. I mentioned Coach K. Did you watch any of the games, the exhibition games against China, or who else did they have? Argentina, I think they
did. I'm not going to lie. I didn't watch a single second of them.
Yeah, I mean, they're not very good from a competitiveness standpoint. You know, they're just rolling teams. They beat China 107-57 the second time. They beat them by a similar amount, maybe 40 or so. Their margin of victory in three exhibition games is just about 45 points, okay? So it's what you expect. It's a loaded team that doesn't even have our best because LeBron isn't there and Steph Curry isn't there. And who else? Russell Westbrook isn't there. And there's, you know, I mean, it's a solid club. Kyrie Irving is there. Kevin Durant is there. But Coach Mike Krzyzewski is not thrilled right now. They're dominating, and everybody wants to see them dominate, but they're getting a little bit too cutesy. Mike Krzyzewski has said they're having way too much fun, and they need to tone it down because it's when you get to that much fun, no matter how good you are. You know, and they've got, I wonder, Draymond Green is still on that team, isn't he?
Yeah, and now you're making me want to check the roster just to double check everybody.
Yeah, the reason I bring up Draymond Green is I'm a little surprised that he, you know, hasn't maybe been sent home for a while after being arrested and charged in an altercation with a Michigan State player in East Lansing. You know, a football player from a couple of weeks ago. So anyway, Coach Krzyzewski basically said they're having too much fun, and the problem with that is, they're going out there and doing things to embarrass their opponents, and it's going to lead to problems, either with that opponent, maybe not liking being clowned upon in such a way, or it's just going to make them lose their focus where they think they can just flip that switch. And against a good team with good international NBA-caliber players, it might come back to cost them. And here's what we're talking about. Toward the end of the second blowout over China, DeMar DeRozan from the Raptors tried to bring the house down. He was coming down the left side of the floor in transition, and a defender met him there, and DeRozan tried a 360 dunk with the defender at the rim. Not just, you know, a 360 dunk like we've seen, or one laid off the glass, you know, an alley-oop off the glass to a teammate.
Sure.
where there's nobody back, where it's an uncontested fast break.
Okay.
But he was just trying to posterize somebody with a 360 in play. And it would have become one of the greatest in-game dunks ever, but he didn't make it because he was fouled. But the U.S. bench went ballistic. Kevin Durant got a tech from the bench just for coming onto the floor and celebrating the near posterization of the opponent.
Because even in exhibition under Olympic rules, they won't tolerate that.
No, well, I don't know. I mean,
it's kind of like the hockey in Winter Olympic hockey. They will not let you fight the way they do in the NHL. They just won't let you do it.
This wouldn't be fighting. You
right.
know what I mean? Well, we're just talking about you know a spectacular move. You can't. I don't think they could possibly penalize because I mean, what happens the next time somebody is going down the lane and they see a defender and they got to do something else fancy and they got to twist and turn and spin and throw it up with the wrong hand or whatever to score. You can't judge someone's intent. If he tries to go up and dunk and he wants to spin on his way up, only he knows what his body control had to be to get free for that shot. I don't think they could punish that. But Krzyzewski sure as heck can because he knows what it is. And he said after the game, he told reporters that his team is having a little bit too much fun and they need to tone that down a little bit. The reason why is, again, they're sloppy when they do that sort of thing. They're having their turnovers rise in each game. They had 12 in the first, 13 in the second, 16 in the third. And the more silly you get with trying to just make boring games entertaining by clowning your opponents, the sloppier your habits get, the sloppier your fundamentals get. And that's the kind of thing where you might not be threatening an exhibition against China. But if you get into a game against some of the better international teams that also have, you know, the French team, for example, is a very, very good team. They've got some studs, and it's not just Tony Parker. But if you get into a matchup against one of these international teams and you're not focused and buckled down or locked in, and you can mix your metaphor there any way you want, but if you're not truly locked in the way you need to be and the way they need to be, you might find yourself in a lot closer game than you wish you were. And I guess that's the point. So Coach K says they're good, they're very good, but they are very, very sloppy, and it's something that that you know because of their clownishness, it's something that he cannot tolerate. So I can't imagine they're going to be threatening this tournament at all if they are locked in. And I got to tell you, I cannot imagine in a million years that Coach K won't do exactly what it takes to get them locked in and to stop clowning around.
Yeah, and you're right. That's the main point here. This team is so talented in terms of the names. I'm looking over the roster once again right now, and they should be beating these types of teams by this margin. But I could see Coach K and others, the rest of the staff, incidentally, is Boeheim, Thibs, and Monty Williams, another assistant coach. That's the coaching staff under Coach K, and I could see that. It's like, okay, I know we're talented.
Did you pull up the roster to get everybody's name?
Yes, I did.
Read that to me. Like I said, I mean, most of the names,
the players,
you know, are fine. Some of them I don't think need to be there, to be honest with you. Some of them I really don't think need to be there. I'm watching that 360, by the way, right now. And it wasn't just a 360 attempt. It was a 360 two-handed attempt. And a spin the opposite way than you normally do a 360 in a dunk contest. He's dribbling down the lane, is DeRozan, on his on the left side. Again, there's a defender at the rim, and he doesn't spin what essentially would be to his left to come back around and finish and dunk with his right hand like a normal 360. He's got both hands on the ball, and he spins to his right, essentially, or, you know, back to the right. I don't know how to describe that, to try to finish with two hands. He got fouled. It was a spectacularly athletic play. But there are some guys who certainly belong on this team, and then there's some other guys who are on it only because LeBron opted out. Steph Curry opted out.
Well, here are the 12 players that are listed as the roster. Yes. Melo, Harrison Barnes, Jimmy Butler.
That's an example. That's an example. Harrison Barnes does not belong on this team. I'm sorry, but go ahead.
Jimmy Butler, DeMarcus Cousins, DeRozan, who you mentioned, Durant, obviously. You got Paul George, Draymond Green, you mentioned Kyrie, also DeAndre Jordan, Klay Thompson, and Kyle Lowry. That's the 12-man roster.
Okay, yeah, and you remember DeAndre Jordan was added when there was some thought that it might be Andre Drummond instead.
Right.
From the Pistons. He was kind of hoping for that phone call, and it did not come. Give me those last three names again.
Kyle Lowry, DeAndre Jordan, and Klay Thompson.
Okay, yeah, Clay makes sense, certainly. DeAndre Jordan was first-team All-NBA. You can't really dispute it, even though I don't think he should have been first-team All-NBA, but he was.
Because that's our argument with how they vote, with the positions they vote for that.
Yes. Exactly right. Yeah, there are a few names on there where I feel like they could have upgraded, but then again, not all of the superstars wanted to play. There is a little controversy, by the way, about Carmelo Anthony. This would be, if he's able to pull it off, his third gold medal. And there are some saying that he
and
really
Lowry are the only players over age 30 on the team. And Melo, he and Kyle Lowry, the only age 30 or older players. Melo's technically the oldest player on the Olympic team at 32.
Okay. All right. There you go. Then that's good to know. But there are some who say that, you know, his time really is done with this. He's already got a couple. There should be enough room on that roster for somebody else looking to make their first, you know, run at a gold medal, and that Melo really shouldn't be there. I don't really feel one way or another about that. I just don't feel like he's one of the 12 best players in the NBA. I like the 12. And I'm getting off on another tangent here. But when the concept of the NBA players first came in 1992 with the Dream Team, it really was supposed to be the 12 best players in the NBA. Well, 11, and then they just, in a nod to the old way of doing things with the college years, they saved one spot on the roster for a college kid, which, of course, was Christian Laettner.
And I was just watching the Christian Laettner 30 for 30 a few days ago and was reminded about that very fact, because you sometimes forget that he was a member of that team.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. Anyway, the point to all of that was, I was listening to an interview with Charles Barkley on another radio program, and it's another subject that I want to get into probably tomorrow, and that is the ongoing commentary by athletes about race and police and everything else that's going on in America, because Michael Jordan has had a say. Charles Barkley responded to that. Richard Sherman is ticking off a lot of people by standing by his All Lives Matter pronouncement, which ticks off a lot of the Black Lives Matter folks and that sort of thing. So more athletes are just getting out in the middle of this, and we're going to have that discussion. But as a part of that interview, Barkley was asked about the 96 Dream Team, you know, because he was on that one also. And the 96 Dream Team, you know, Dream Team 2.0, if you will, was never anywhere near what the 92 Dream Team was. And Barkley essentially laid it out and said he hated being a part of that 1996 team. He said he didn't enjoy it at all. He said it was kind of like a nightmare. He said for the whole couple months of the 92 team, they got along like it was the greatest thing in the world, and nobody had an ego. But he said in 96, guys started complaining about playing time. Guys started saying, well, I should be starting. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is Barkley quoting, y'all aren't even good enough compared to the team that I used to be on. He said unnamed players would skip practices as a protest for not starting or because they were unsatisfied with their minutes. He said it was just not a lot of fun hearing guys, quoting him now, bear with me, bitch and complain all the time about who should be starting. In 96, it was a nightmare. Guys complained about their time the whole time, and I hated it. I bring that up only because the Melo thing. Carmelo Anthony has never struck me as being the LeBron, the Wade, the Durant, the type of superstars who truly are more devoted and dedicated to winning. He's more interested in getting his, you know, his shots, his points, his accolades. And to me, I want the 12 best guys on that Olympic team with our pros now, who are more dedicated to getting it done. The way they buried their egos in the 92 team. Larry Bird didn't even want to start. His back was killing him anyway. He started because they made him. He was perfectly fine with deferring to everybody else, including Magic, his rival. But Magic and Barkley and Ewing and Robinson and Malone and all these guys, they wanted to prove it to one another in practice who the better players were, and they went at it hard. But when it came time to the team, they were like brothers. And they were like, I don't care if I get 5 shots this game or 1 shot or 15 shots. And I don't care how many minutes I play. We want to prove to everybody we're the best in the world. Today, I look at a guy like Carmelo on this team, and I don't think that's there anymore. I don't think that's there. Not at all. But some of the guys that they have, I can see being more like that 96 team. DeMarcus Cousins is one of the best players in basketball. He is certainly the best center in basketball. He's a dominant big, and he's on his way to getting better and better. But you know what he isn't? He isn't a team player. He isn't a guy I would want around. I wouldn't want him around anymore than I want Dwight Howard around. Draymond Green might be a great player, does a lot of things well, is an unselfish player, and that's good. But with everything else we know about him and the personality stuff, I don't know if I'd want him around. I guess what I'm saying is, and maybe what I'm asking, is are you going to watch the Olympic basketball games? I haven't watched any of these trials that I'm talking about, or not trials, the exhibition games, other than that dunk that I was just telling you about, which I will share on Facebook right after the end of this program. So anybody who wants to see it, you can go onto our Facebook page at 1065theticket.com. Or I'm sorry, the Facebook page at 1065theticket on Facebook. But Excuse me. But I'm not going to be that interested in it. I think I'm a little bit over it. I think I'm a little bit over the, you know, the whole we're going to beat everybody by 50 and screw around and clown them type of attitude, I guess, that Olympic basketball for Team USA has become.
You know, this discussion has made me look up exactly who was on that that 96 team you're talking about. And two things pop out of me. One, remember how I said there's only two guys on this current one right now, Mello and Lowry, who are age 30 or older, and everyone else is under that?
Right.
It was the opposite was essentially true of the 96 team. Only three players were under 30 out of the 12. There were five holdovers from the 92 team. Barkley, along with Karl Malone, Scottie Pippen, Stockton, and David Robinson were played on 92 and 96.
Give me those again.
Charles Barkley, Karl Malone, Scottie Pippen, John Stockton, and David Robinson. They were on 92 and 96. The others, meaning the ones who replaced the Jordans and the Birds, you had Penny Hardaway, Grant Hill, Reggie Miller, Hakeem, Gary Payton, Mitch Richmond.
Wow, that's a very, very different sounding crew than that
first
one.
Yes, it is.
Wow. Give me those last ones again.
The players who were only 96 but not 92?
Yes.
Penny Hardaway, Grant Hill, who was with the Pistons at the time, Reggie Miller, Hakeem Olajuwon, and then you add Gary Payton and Mitch Richmond. Oh, and I completely forgot.
And Hakeem wasn't even eligible because he wasn't a U.S. citizen in 92.
Right, but he was on the 96 roster. Yeah, I'm looking
because
at it right
became,
now. The other player I forgot
a US
was Shaq.
Citizen in between 92 and 96, I believe, is the way it worked out. Because remember, he's from Nigeria.
Yes.
So
that's
why
true.
He wasn't on that first team.
Exactly.
The actual Dream Team in 92.
I'm pretty sure that's exactly what the reason was. And incidentally, I mentioned there were only three who were under 30, which is the opposite of this year's team. The three who were under 30 were Gary Payton at 28 and a couple 24-year-olds, Shaq and Penny.
And now you got a lot of these young puppies, you know, who, quite frankly, like I said, I just don't know if they necessarily understand and grasp exactly what it is they're being asked to do. I think they're going to be more like the Team 96 team than the team, than the 1996 team than the 1992 team, which, of course, changed international basketball forever.
And incidentally, based on exactly what you just said, they should, but and we won't be mentioning it much if they do their job, which is to be undefeated and win gold, because we really that's part of the reason I don't honestly watch a lot of Olympic basketball, especially relative to, say, Olympic hockey in the Winter Games.
Right.
Because it's only real. Let's just be straight up here, Bob. It's only a story if the U.S. does not win gold.
Yeah.
Let's
be fair. And it's really only a story if the U.S. doesn't win by 30. I mean, to be honest with you, you know, for the most part, that's
yeah. I suppose. But, you know, I think back to, what was it, the 04 team? I can't remember. Was it 04 that they won bronze? And you're thinking, should we – I remember the conversation at the time. Should we just stop doing this NBA player thing because the U.S. stubbed their toe and won bronze that year?
I can't remember, though, what the circumstances of that were.
They lost to Argentina, and they lost to, like, Lithuania or somebody.
Yeah, but, I mean, who was on the team? I mean, because I remember what we said was, it doesn't count because we didn't send our best. When we sent our best, like we did with the original Dream Team in 92, nobody in the world could stay within 50 of us. But then we started sending our second and third tier NBA players.
Well, here we go. Here's the roster for the 2004 one. And,
so 12 years ago. So that was three Olympics ago.
Three Olympics ago. You had Allen Iverson.
Okay.
Stephon Marbury.
See, that's terrible right there. Go ahead.
Dwayne Wade, Carlos Boozer, Melo, LeBron, Emeka Okafor, because he just got drafted.
Terrible.
Sean Marion, Amari Stoudemire, Duncan, who was the captain of the team, Lamar Odom, and Richard Jefferson.
Terrible. And not terrible. I mean, Richard Jefferson, he's a great guy, and he's obviously a member of the Cavaliers championship team. But, I mean, let's be honest with you. You know, probably six of those guys belong on an Olympic team, about six of them. There's no way that some of those guys belong in it, and I fear, I fear right now, to be honest with you, that the names you read of this year's team kind of could lead that same type of thing now.
And we know there are better careers now, but this is 2004, so when I say Dwayne Wade and Carmelo Anthony and LeBron James, that's rookie
that
or
second
year.
Year
at best, exactly.
Right. That was right after the rookie seasons.
Right. And the games they lost the opener, strangely, by 19 to Puerto Rico, wow. And you knew something was up. Yeah, they lose another group play to Lithuania, lost the semifinal to Argentina.
Who coached them? Who coached them?
Larry Brown, and Pop was an assistant.
Yeah, and there was a big problem there between Larry Brown and a bunch of those guys. But
I can see that, though. You're talking about Larry Brown. I mean, I know Pistons fans will remember
Larry Brown didn't play LeBron. That was part of it. I remember that. He didn't think LeBron deserved very much time.
Right.
He was not a fan.
Right, that's true.
So that was a big deal. All right, hey, listen, before we go, I want to hook you up with something outstanding. I've got a ticket sweet deal of the week. Tomorrow morning, you get to log on to 1065theticket.com starting at 9 o'clock, and while supplies last, you can pick up a $50 gift certificate to Backyard Barbecue and Booze on Sylvania Avenue for just $25. Or, to make it even easier for you, I want to hook you up right now with a freebie, a free $50 gift certificate to Backyard Barbecue and Booze on Sylvania Avenue to the 10th caller at 866-240-1065 as we head out the door. 866-240-1065. Caller 10, that is yours. Everybody else, get it for just 25 bones tomorrow morning starting at 9 at 1065theticket.com. Drive time is next. I'll see you tomorrow.
1065 The Ticket right now.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.